when I've gone to some of these Cove Roosts, they really do a number on my truck, and I have to go to the car wash right afterwards. And so I kind of wonder if they go, yeah, that's Bobby Sanchez. Let's go visit his truck.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Compared to other species, humans have an outsized ecological impact on our surroundings. So it's important to understand and study the habits of other animals we share the world with. Coming up, we'll hear how scientists are studying a rare stonefly species in the Grand Tetons and about a recently deceased condor in Wyoming. Plus, how residents of an Idaho city are trying to outsmart a murder of crows. In wide open spaces, like the rural parts of the Mountain West, there's sometimes little known about the secret lives of plants and animals. There are too many square miles and too few scientists. That's where citizen scientists can come to the rescue. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen checked out their role surveying moose in one corner of Wyoming.
If you've ever looked around the place where you live and made some kind of observation about the natural world, then you're well on your way to becoming a citizen scientist.
Citizen science is when scientists enlist volunteers to help conduct scientific research.
That's Zoe Nelson. She works at the Berry Biodiversity Institute on the University of Wyoming's campus. The institute runs citizen science projects all over the state. Here's how it works.
Scientists ask a question, design a protocol, and then we work with them to help recruit volunteers, retain volunteers, and answer that question through collecting field data.
Which brings us to the moose survey. Wyoming's Game and Fish Department has a job for some citizen scientists and wants to know more about the animal in the Snowy Mountain Range in southeastern Wyoming. But before volunteers are sent out into the field, they need to know what to look for. Alex May is a graduate student in zoology and physiology and gave the training this year. For starters, it included where to look.
In this area, they're really closely tied to river corridors and aspen stands. So if you're going up in the mountains, you know, trying to stay near streams or rivers is a really good first step.
And if a citizen scientist spots a moose on their route, May says there are particular data points they're supposed to collect.
Where they see the moose, what the sex is, so is it a male or female, approximate age, and then whether there's a calf or two even with the female.
The bulk of the training is being able to get an idea for those things just by looking at the moose. For example, adult females will have a white blaze mark on their rump, and males will have antlers or exposed bone of the skull depending on the time of year. May says it's also important to look for signs of things that may be hurting the moose population.
The arterial worm and the winter tick are two parasites that moose can have that you can sometimes see evidence of.
Like ears that look as if they've been snipped off on top, or big patches of bare skin and hair that has turned white. If a citizen scientist doesn't see any moose on moose day, that's just as important. Zoe Nelson says no data is still data.
Zero is a number in science, and I think that that is also a really cool kind of statement to help hopefully draw deeper connections into the scientific process.
Zero is a number citizen scientist Ken Zajac and his hiking buddy Bob Kubicek are familiar with. I've met up with them for their ninth moose day.
Did you mention to Maggie that we've been doing this for however many years and we've never seen a moose yet?
We're in Kubicek's truck, headed to Vitavu, an area of rocky outcrops within the Medicine Bow Route National Forest. It's about 20 miles outside of Laramie. Soon after we hit a gravel road, we come to a gate meant to stop vehicles.
The seasonal closure. Stop here and walk.
Yep, that's it.
The 5-mile route we'll hike today has been predetermined by the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. It selects about 30 different routes in southeastern Wyoming twice a year for Moose Day. Then, volunteers sign up for the route of their choosing to hike on a date that is also predetermined. Kubicek says they got involved with Moose Day back when it started in 2015.
That was the first I'd ever heard of the whole citizen science idea.
His buddy, Ken Zajac, says it's also a good excuse to get outside.
Especially out here in Wyoming. We got some of the last good stuff left.
We've made it to the part of the route that's surrounded by willows. Kubicek says that's prime moose habitat.
Well, pretty deluxe place to eat, you know, buffet.
Soon we come around a bend and stop right in our tracks. We stay as quiet as we can because just to the left of the trail, about 30 yards away, we've spotted a moose. It's pretty big and it doesn't have a white patch on its rump, so we guess that it's an adult male. We stand there for a while, the moose looking at us looking at him, then it disappears back into the trees.
Well, finally.
Yes.
Always great to see a moose, always.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Scientists know very little about a species of stonefly that can only be found in the Grand Teton's alpine streams. The Lednia tetonica was discovered in 2012, but as climate change slowly melts glaciers and threatens the aquatic insect's habitat, researchers are trying to learn as much as they can about the species before it disappears. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has more.
On a cold morning at a Grand Teton's campground, three scientists are packing their bags for an expedition.
It's about 6 a.m. People are just starting to wake up, and we're heading to the Skillet Glacier later today.
That's Scott Hotelling, a postdoctoral scholar at Washington State University. He's alongside Lesha Tronstadt.
I'm the invertebrate zoologist at the University of Wyoming.
These scientists and a graduate student have been visiting sites around the Tetons for over a week, collecting data on a stonefly species unique to the mountain range, the Lednia tetonica. The small brown aquatic fly lives only in rock and surface glacier-fed streams. In the first leg of their journey to today's site, Skillet Glacier, the team jumps on a boat. For the last 4 years, a small group of researchers, including Tronstadt and Hotelling, has been racing to study the insect and the streams it lives in.
See the little handle going up?
It looks like a snow guitar.
Yeah, it's a snow guitar. And there's the stream coming out of it that we'll be walking up.
Okay, you guys ready?
Very little is known about what lives in these alpine streams. These scientists are the first people to really investigate what's there.
We call ourselves the Alpine Stream Dream Team.
And they think what they find might be important. With climate change heating up temperatures in the insect's habitat, the rush to learn about it pushes the stakes even higher.
Icy stream habitat goes away. This whole world goes away and is replaced by a warmer temperature community that is different. And that's a significant blow to global biodiversity.
After the short boat ride, the scientists head upward on the long, trailless hike. Hotelling explains after today and many more days like it, the team will have a huge collection of the basic natural history of the species, the insect's population density, the microbes in the water, and how the temperature changes annually.
We need these long-term data sets to fully clarify how these changes are happening on a year-to-year basis, or a decade-to-decade.
Already, the team has uncovered 9 new sites where the stonefly lives, out of only 10. After hours of bushwhacking through willows and climbing over boulders, the alpine streams come into view. Soon, Hotelling lifts up a rock and uncovers a small brown wriggling insect.
All right, here's one of the stars of our alpine stream show. This is Lednia tetonica right here. You see this little dark brown stonefly?
The insect clings to rocks as freezing water rushes past it. It's the size of an ant, and sort of nondescript. Tronstadt explains this stonefly is important to its ecosystem by dealing with big organic matter like leaves, sticks, and moss.
And they usually shred those up and make them into smaller pieces, and other organisms can use them downstream. So
they're also important because, as an indicator species, it's like a canary in a coal mine. As stoneflies start going away with warming waters, that means climate change could be having other impacts in the alpine stream ecosystem, and that affects water everywhere.
These are the headwaters of the world, and so everything that happens up here, all the organisms that live and die, all the water that flows out of a glacier, it all goes into Jackson Lake down here, and it continues until it goes out into the world's oceans.
Hotelling moves up and down the stream in search of 20 lednia to study later. Further down, the graduate student is brushing stones from the stream, collecting algae, fungi, and bacteria. Over time, her research will show how lednia food sources could be changing with the climate. 10 feet away, Tronstadt gathers data on the stream.
I was saying that there wasn't a lot of algae in the stream. It was, if you guys concurred.
She notes how much algae is in the stonefly's habitat, what rock sizes are there, pH, as well as what other insects are present to learn population density. While they still can, scientists are collecting this baseline data and will watch over the course of years as climate change transforms this world.
And watching, waiting, and collecting data every year is really the best thing we can do to figure out how this is all going to play out and end.
The next morning, after a steep downward hike from Skillet Glacier, a new question around the stoneflies is being addressed. If it can withstand warmer temperatures, some scientists have already learned it can, though not well. O'Telling says it's one more question they'll have to take on. And that's no problem.
We'll be back. I mean, that's definitely the only constant is we will show up next year.
There's more to learn about this tiny brown alpine species, and it could have bigger implications than the tiny stonefly itself. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
A California condor recently flew from Arizona to Wyoming, but it died shortly after arriving. California condors are an endangered species, and the bird was being tracked and was taken in for a necropsy by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. After the cause of death was determined, the University of Wyoming Museum of Vertebrates was given the body for research and education. Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam sat down with the museum's curator and collections manager, Elizabeth Womack, to find out more about this condor.
The condor coming to Wyoming is significant for a couple different reasons. The first one is for the fact that we're not supposed to have condors here sort of within modern history. So condors' range was restricted at the early part of the 20th century to Southern California. We know that they were in Arizona. There are written accounts from European settlers who had seen them down in Arizona. But there had been no written accounts of them at that time period up in Wyoming. There is some questionable accounts of them. And there are no Pleistocene records from them here. So at the same time, there's no reason it couldn't have come here. They're restricted to sort of mountain ranges where there are large open plains that they can scavenge for food, which sounds really similar to Wyoming. The other reason that it's really interesting that that bird particular came here is because it's from the released population. And so our bird was bred in a zoo in Oregon, and then she was released in northern Arizona, and she made her way away from that population, and they're fairly social birds. And she sort of went on a wander journey and she came all the way up north to us. And there is one other condor that's known from that population, an adult female who wandered up into sort of out of Utah into the very southern tip of Wyoming and then sort of wandered back down, and she bred and was absolutely fine. But this bird didn't come up from Utah. She must have come up from Colorado and like came around and hang out in Medicine Bow.
So condors are pretty rare and were actually considered extinct at one point. What's the reason for the decline in their population?
So California condors, it's a really unique species. They're a humongous bird. They're the largest flying bird in North America, the second largest flying bird in the New World. And they are sometimes what people call a Pleistocene relic. There were many more condors, and we believe that they fed off of the megafauna that was there. They're an iconic species. They really sort of represent, it's fascinating reading the accounts of explorers in Southern California, even people who've spent a lot of the time out there. They say the minute you see a condor is like the one most amazing minute of your day, your month, or your year. They are somewhat tied to large areas of dead game. They are a scavenger species. So, you know, the lack of the megafauna, the die-off of the large bison herds and such, they've sort of constricted to the coastline. And so they eat a lot of the marine mammals that wash up there. They'll also eat things. There's records of them eating salmon on the salmon runs up in Oregon and Washington. They'll eat, you know, down to jackrabbit size prey. The other really interesting thing and why they're so important is they're kind of being used as sort of a indicator species. So one of the reasons they're having such a hard time reintroducing them is they're falling prey to a lot of lead poisoning. And a lot of the work on the condors have shown that when a hunter kills or a game warden or something kills an animal with a lead-based shot, it turns out they fraction
a lot. And the x-rays are amazing. It looks literally like a little snowstorm in the animal. So what happens is you clean out your gut pile, and if you leave your gut pile there, scavengers are going to come to it, and it turns out they're consuming a lot of lead. So a lot of the work going on with that has started with the California condors, trying to figure out how can we reintroduce this iconic species and make them viable.
Once this condor made it to Wyoming, it died, and there was a lot of concern over the reasons it died. Why was it taken so seriously? What were those concerns?
So I think people were worried first off that maybe something man-made resulted in its death. Some of the other introduced birds have hit power lines. There was no record of anyone hitting it with a car. I think somebody would notice that they hit a condor with a car. But, you know, what if it flew into a fence line? I think people were worried that something we did here in Wyoming caused this bird to die. And because it was only the second record, and really when the call came out that she was there, people were so excited that she was. And I think a lot of our hopes were that she would fly out of the state, grow up, and then come back and sort of start, you know, maybe visit us again. So we were worried that it was man-made was the cause of her death. And it turns out it wasn't. So something to do with her neurological system, they think, went wrong.
So what's the end of this bird's story? What's going to happen with her body?
She's now become a specimen at the University of Wyoming Museum of Vertebrates. So we got special permission from the federal government to house her here. It's amazing to have her here. And truthfully, while her life has stopped, her use, her future is not. It's going to continue on. That means people can come here and they can study how large and what shape a California condor wing looks like compared to other birds of prey that come here in Wyoming. They can look at her bone structure. How is her skull different than, say, like a red-tailed hawk or a turkey vulture? School students can come and do art projects associated with her. Genetic researchers can come and ask us for a subsample of that tissues. So essentially, her life after death will probably never stop.
Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam speaking with UW Museum of Vertebrates curator Elizabeth Womack. While the condor's visit to Wyoming brought excitement, residents of an Idaho community would love to see a murder of crows fly out of town. Yes, a group of crows is called a murder. Imagine a swarm of big black birds flying overhead at dusk. No, it's not a scene from a Hitchcock film. This is Nampa, Idaho, the new winter home for tens of thousands of crows. They are noisy and messy, and Nampa residents are pushing back. The Mountain West News Bureau's Amanda Peacher reports.
For the last few months, at about 5 p.m. every evening, this sound starts blasting from a loudspeaker outside a small business in Nampa. That's a recording of a hawk. They eat crows. So Jim Jorgensen thought it could be a good trick for scaring off the birds.
And it worked really good for the first month. And they just got braver and braver, and now it doesn't help a whole lot.
You see, crows are smart. It's possible they figured out Jorgensen's trick. And that's a problem for him. He manages Fast Glass, which installs glass in houses and cars. Thousands of crows mean thousands of bird droppings on his equipment and vehicle fleet. Jorgensen spends hundreds of dollars every month pressure washing his building and cleaning his vehicles. The city is trying to help, but it's tough to outsmart a crow.
Yes, we like to use the term proactive. We're very proactive here.
That's Nampa City Manager Bobby Sanchez. He says he doesn't expect to get rid of the crows.
At best, we will be able to manage the crow challenge.
To that end, Sanchez has organized what he calls the Crow Patrol.
I'm guessing you're my crow people.
Yes.
His crow people are city staffers plus volunteers from the community. Daylight is just starting to fade to gray when I meet them in a big parking lot lined with trees. This is the crow's latest favorite roosting spot.
I'm Darren.
Darren?
Yes.
Nice to meet you.
Darren Johnson manages parks and recreation for the city. He watches as at first only a few big birds glide above us.
They are beautiful, and just the way they move is just such a kind of like a majestic pattern.
The birds swarm in an S shape far above the beams of the parking lot lights. In the distance, more and more crows appear on the horizon as tiny black dots flowing toward us like a river in the sky.
If you just keep scanning to your left, they just keep coming.
I mean, the sky is just full of them above us now.
And then, all of a sudden, the crows settle in. They dive bomb from the sky and into the branches of the trees. It's not totally clear why the crows picked here for their winter gathering spot. But natural resource biologist Josh Collette says all the asphalt here absorbs the heat.
The urban setting has created a little thermal hotspot for them, so it's a few degrees warmer here.
There's also the city dumpsters nearby, plus the agricultural fields surrounding Nampa that provide lots of food for the birds. But right now, they're not eating. Thousands of them are sitting wing to wing in the bare trees surrounding our crow patrol. It's a little unsettling. So it's time for the crow patrol to get to work. Johnson brings out his first trick, a laser. He directs a bright green beam toward the roost.
They see it kind of as a stick coming towards them, and it feels like they're going to get hit by a stick, and so they don't like that.
He's right. The crows take off. Johnson says these trees have also been treated with a non-lethal but stinky chemical.
Ew, it smells like grape juice.
You would think that they'd like the grape juice.
Yeah, you would think so, but they don't like grapes, I guess.
The stink kept the birds away for a while. But you guessed it, they came back. Remember, crows are smart. But tonight there's another trick to try. A drone. Nampa police officer Jacob Pepper slowly hovers the drone toward a roost.
Once you do kind of startle them off and try to get them moving, it just kind of, it's kind of scary, honestly, with all those crows up in the air.
Scary, but the drone is shooing the birds off. But will the crows figure out this trick, too? City manager Bobby Sanchez sometimes wonders if the crows know that he's the one behind all these scare tactics. He might not be that far off. While we humans can't tell crows apart, they can actually remember human faces.
When I've gone to some of these crow roosts, they really do a number on my truck, and I have to go to the car wash right afterwards. And so I kind of wonder if they go, yeah, that's Bobby Sanchez. Let's go visit his truck and then go about our day.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher.
And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. You can join us again for a new episode in a couple of weeks. And if you like what you're hearing, you can help other people find the show by leaving a rating or review wherever you're listening. David Graff produced this episode. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell. And I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.